today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
At the races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour two on this Thursday, and Tony Black standing by, and you never know what Tony's doing. He might be shopping for his mother. He might be doing some yard work. He might be, who knows? It's certainly nice enough for him at this point with the winter in the rearview mirror to get back on horses, you lazy jock, you.
You hit the nail right on the head. One thing, you never know what I'm doing, and getting on horses, yeah, I was lazy. But today, I'll tell you what, my little boy's been sick for the last couple of days, kept him home from school, so I'm the nurse today, again. So I didn't go out and get on horses, and I used my little boy as an excuse, but it's a good excuse, because he couldn't go to school. Hey, that's the one thing the school has been sending home, emails and notes saying what's going on there, and there's a lot of kids sick at the flu virus going around, and hopefully it has nothing to do with COVID. He whatever they got going on over there, he finally succumbed to it. So I kept him home the last couple of days.
It's funny on that topic, because we were in Rochester on Sunday on the way back, of course, from Louisville. And the kids, both of the grandkids, are both nursing off and on. They both have been sick. And sure enough, after we left, we heard later, we got a text later on that that poor Lennon, she was knocked out. And so she's been home, for at least 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It's already Thursday. So we'll get an update today. But, yeah, same thing. She was knocked out.
It's just what's going around. And I try to tell him when he's not feeling real good and everything, and he's coughing. I say, cover your mouth when you cough. You're spreading the germs when you're coughing into the air like that. And then my little girl, she went to school, but they sent home some information yesterday and the day before where she was exposed to some kids, that have come up positive with COVID. Saying, geez, we just got to really keep her alert and make sure that, if she shows any symptoms or if anybody shows any symptoms. We have the home test kits. I've got a couple of these test kits and make sure to see if what's going on with them, if they have any, tests that would come up positive. But I haven't kept her home. And, it's just that's kind of the nature of what's going on, people. I even said to my little boy, I was saying, maybe we're dropping our guard a little too early when it comes to this whole situation, and we should really be careful about getting into crowds and everything. And he plays AAU basketball, and he belongs to the township team. And of course, they have allowed parents now to come watch the kids play, where before they wouldn't let us come watch them play. And I'm thinking, well, they're easing all the restrictions up, but I hope it's just not too soon that they're easing some of these restrictions up.
Well, you're not alone in that speculation, and in fact, I've had, it's funny, I've had doctor visits the last 2 days, and because I've got another next to the people who wrote me about the cardiology, that called the other day, because I'm having another procedure a couple days after get back from Preakness, and they have reinstituted the masks. And yesterday at the dentist, because I'm finally getting that thing fixed from the broken tooth at Christmas time. I mean, it's unbelievable how long that ordeal takes. I mean, that's the craziest, what a system that is, where they do one thing and then you wait 90 days, then they do another thing now. And so anyway, that's happening. So, and they put masks back on you yesterday when I went to the dentist. So you're not wrong. And it's funny, I've had at least two people in the last 10 days mention to me that they're home with COVID. So yeah, listen, this is what it's going to be, I guess, the rest of the way. And downstate, our son Spencer, he was with us. You know, we picked him up in Rochester. He was visiting the baby, his niece and nephew. So he spent a couple of days with us too. And he's starting a new job in the city government, not just city, actually state too. And he says that they're downstate, that they're back on the alarm as well. So I hear you. You're not wrong, Tony.
Yeah, you know, it's something that everybody wants to get back to normal, but let's get back to normal in due time when we're sure that we're not going to reinfect and get this thing while going like wildfire again. But one thing about it, when we watched the Derby the other day, you know, not that you saw this, but I'm thinking...
No, go ahead.
Watching the Derby the other day, we could see if there was any place where everybody should be careful. We should have been there. But when it came to watching the race, there was a lot of excitement. And, of course, Rich Strike and Sonny Leone and the trainer, they didn't have any COVID. Rich Strike sure didn't have any problems showing his ability off. It was an exciting race. And you think of 100,000+ were out there watching it. And not 1 minute while I was watching it did I think about COVID. I was thinking about how exciting it is to be at the Derby, and I was really excited when I saw the stretch run before Sonny Leone got Rich Strike past everybody, because I was watching Mutual Source, Epic Center, and I was rooting for Epic Center, and of course Zandon I thought was to beat in the race, but rooting for Epic Center just strictly because Vernon Winchell went to the Derby in 1981. I think it was the first horse he'd ever run in the Derby, and I rode it, a horse called Classic Go-Go, and finished fourth. And he, you know, was a man who really loved horse racing. He said, my biggest dream in life, he was telling me at the race, I just want to win the Derby someday. Well, Mr. Winchell has since passed, but the son has kept the same colors and kept the outfit alive. And when I saw those maroon colors with the W on them coming down the stretch, I was really excited for the owner, the present-day owner, Vernon's son. But I was thinking, well, Mr. Winchell, I hope you're up there looking down, and you look like you might win a Derby, and then here comes Rich Strike down the fence. And 80-1 shot that drew in on Friday, and I'm thinking, geez, how tough is it on this man to someday win a Derby? He looked like he was going to get it done today. And a horse that probably, we should say, shouldn't even have been, wasn't even going to be in the race, beat you. So my heart went out to that outfit, you know, because I guess just strictly because I was connected to it. And he was such a nice man. The day, I'll never forget when the horse ran, he says, well, what do you want for coming today? I really appreciate it. And I said, it's just a thrill of being a Derby. I don't want anything. I was thrilled to be fourth. And I think that year it was 21 horses, because there was an entry in the race, I believe. And I think it was 21. I'm not sure, but there was a lot of dispute over the number of horses that ran in it that year. But, of course, there came a check into the jock's room for a substantial amount, and I thought to myself, what a class act. Yeah, I didn't even want anything but to be part of this whole show. And he not only paid my expenses, he gave me a little bit of money just to for coming to the Derby, and he was thrilled to be fourth. And I want to see this Vernon Winchell colors get across that wire one day in front, someday soon.
They'll you got to think they'll get one. And it with you mentioned Ron Winchell going on with Winchell Thoroughbreds.
Right.
Not only has he gone on, but the situation that you know that they find themselves in is just unbelievable. I mean, he's to have not just the Tappet progeny, but now he's got the Gunrunner. You know what's going to be clearly a fountainhead, Tony, of horses with Gunrunner, and you know that's just part of the you know the Winchell scenario. I mean, he between what he buys and then now he's going to have Epicenter long term too. It's just amazing what he's gone. Most times an operation will maybe maintain or they'll start to pare down. In fact, this came up yesterday with Sid in Pedigree Focus, but he has taken it to another a whole nother level for the Winchell name. Let's talk about Sonny Leone's ride, Tony, and you know, I'm sure you've seen the overhead a few times now too.
Right.
It's just amazing, and I don't have the Derby winners in front of me, but when you fold in the three from Calvin Burrell and the two from Mario Gutierrez, fold in a Stewie Elliott, when you now Sonny Leone, doesn't this say that if you've got a horse that's got the goods, that any level of rider, no matter how experienced, inexperienced, how famous, how many other grade one wins, when you see that, that's three for Burrell, two, that's five, Stewart, and so in the last 17 years or so, you got seven Derby wins from guys that, you know, that weren't household names, that weren't, you know, first call at A tracks. It's, to me, it's quite something.
Yeah, you know, it just shows, you know, they're everyday capable riders. You know, they've won their share of races and races that had no name or no prestige attached to them. But you're talking about riders that, like I said, everyday riders that won races. But it just also shows this, and this is what I look at a race like the Derby or any race. It shows how important the horse is when you watch Rich Strike run, or horses like Mind That Bird and Calvin Burrell Road, or other horses that won the Derby. It shows how important the horse is, as important as we may want to think being us jockeys are. It just shows how important, so important that the horse is. Because these horses that win in these big fields, you know, they have to be the kind of horse that has the mentality to do what not only you want them to do, but to do what they want to do. And that means they have to be horses that are willing to run into dirt. They have to be horses that are willing, if they're up against the fence with outside traffic, to maintain their position. They have to be horses that are in, if they're in large fields and have horses on both sides of them, they have to be horses that will run with competition, sometimes making the forward path not as comfortable as and clear as you would like it to be. You know, they have to be horses that don't need a specific certain setup to run their race. They don't have to be on the outside. They don't have to be not getting hit with dirt. They don't have to be horses that aren't in traffic, and they always have to have a clear shot. When you watch Rich Strike run, he had forward position that he was able to run to in most parts of the race. The 20 horses, in some respects, they were not all stacked up in a tight position. You know, they were kind of spread out. And that's to the advantage of a rider that's trying to save ground. He knows his horse will run into dirt. He knows his horse, even though they're spread out, won't be intimidated by having to come between horses or to the inside of horses. As long as he can give them a clear path in front of him where there's daylight to move someplace forward if your horse is starting to accelerate when you're asking him. And as we see, as he was coming to the down the stretch, you know, there was a horse that was not clearly, he wasn't going to be able to go through on that horse. He was on the fence, and then he came out and around and went around that one horse. And his horse was willing to run into the clear spots without hesitation. And Sonny Leon gave him every opportunity to see a clear spot in front of him where he wasn't going to be in behind horses and up their in their heels or up their asses, let's say. Plain and simple. So, you know, it takes a specific and a certain kind of horse that has that courage to go where you want them. You know, horses are, it's not like riding a motorcycle. Motorcycle has accelerator and a brake. Well, so do horses have accelerators and the reins as a brake. But there's one thing that they also have. They have a thinking brain, whereas a vehicle doesn't have the brain to interfere with what you want to do. And horses have a brain who, at times, interfere with what you're asking them to do. And in this particular case, we can see that horse was willing to do whatever that rider asked him to do in giving him a clear shot for forward motion, forward movement. And it's exciting to watch a horse come through the crowd of horses like that. And like I said, the horses were spread out. But that doesn't matter if you're on a horse that, you know, so many times you ride horses and you say, geez, I got to keep the dirt out of this horse's face. As soon as he gets hit with dirt, he climbs. Or as soon as he gets on the inside with traffic to the outside, I mean, he's hesitant. He doesn't want to move forward. I have to come around horses because this horse doesn't run good with traffic to the outside of him. And, boy, it makes a job tough for a rider when you're riding a horse that's like that, you know, that has his own way of doing things, and he's trying to think more than you're thinking, you know? But when you watch this horse run, he's one of them kind that's going to run where you ask him, when you ask him, and that's just exactly what he did on Saturday. And it does make a rider's job a lot easier when you have a horse that will go any place when you ask him.
How about the aspect of this, because I've told the story, Tony, so many times. When, I guess it was on Friday, yeah, it must have been Oaks Day, when came up I got in one of the elevators to go upstairs, and Mario Gutierrez from, so this has got to be 2012, when I'll have another one. I got in the elevator, and there's Mario Gutierrez, who looked like, first of all, looked like he was 13. And and it looked like a deer in the headlights. And I thought to myself, well, I said, I'm not going to have to worry about it. I'll have another tomorrow. And then I watched we were still up on the sixth floor then, and I just remembered some people weren't sure who it was, and you know, easy to identify those silks. And of Paul Renham, and I said, it's Doug O'Neill and it's Mario Gutierrez. And I was just amazed. And then, of course, he comes back and wins a second. It would kind of you know, get thrown into the face of the dialogue that this is a race that, you know, you need to be a seasoned veteran and you need to be, you have to have a certain level of experience. I mean, for a guy like this to come in and turn in that ride is just incredible. I don't know how to say it. I mean, and you would think that if you ran this race 100 times, you would expect that he would run into some traffic and make a bad decision at some point. I mean, is it a case where you're the longest shot on the board, there's no pressure on you, and, you know the horse is going to come with a run, so, you know, you just are, you're just loose and free, there's no nerves? I mean, how does a kid, not a kid, he's, you know, in his 30s, I think, how does he turn in a ride like this?
Well, you know, I can't speak for everyone, but I believe that so many of you riders that have this attitude, and it's an attitude that I learned to develop right from the first horse I ever got on and rode in a race. Where, you know, your first mount, you say, man, there's nerves riding your first race. It's got to be. And I went out to the paddock, and I always remembered this, and I always make it. I went out to the paddock, and of course, I'm sitting in the jocks room waiting for this race, you know, to check and us to go out. And I went out and walked through the jocks room doors into the paddock at the old Liberty Bell, and here's my trainer sitting there, and here's the horse I'm supposed to ride. And a trainer, you know, I probably don't remember a word he said. And when he gave me the leg up, I thought to myself, wait a minute, what the hell are you doing? Why are you nervous? This is what you trained to do for the last 3 years. And all of a sudden, that attitude, this is what you do, you trained to do all these years, overpowered everything. And I'm thinking, the nerves just totally went away. It reminded me of being a wrestler when I was wrestling high school. You know, maybe the first couple of matches you went out there and you had some anxiety and nerves, and then all of a sudden you went out there and you were knocking these kids around and you're putting them on their back and pinning them and, you know, and or beating them up. And this is what you train to do every day in the wrestling room. This is what you train to do. And that mentality and that mindset carried through with me, where anxiety was put aside and the importance of, oh, this is a special race, was put aside. Because it's no different than when you're riding a $3,000 claimer going going a mile an eighth and it's in a large field, which you don't get a lot of experience in fields of this size, but it's no different. You start to think, this is what I trained to do. This is what my profession is. This is what I am, a jockey. And you put all that aside. This is what I believe a real professional does. You know, same way where they call these people natural athletes. You know, and there'll be some baseball player or some pitcher or football player. He's a natural. You know what a natural is? A natural is, to me, this is what I thought of a natural is, where all that anxiety is put aside and you call on and utilize your energy and your ability when called upon. That's a natural athlete, and you don't let anxiety get in the way with your performance, because anxiety can be your biggest competitor in any sport. Anxiety, it wastes you. It wastes your energy, it wastes your focus, it wastes your natural talent. And this is what you have to be when you're a jockey, because you're going to do it 7, 6, 7, 8 times a day. You better not have a lot of anxiety, because you won't have enough energy to get through the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 mounts you ride a day. And I think that carries over when a jock gets that leg up in the paddock in the Derby, I think that's when all the butterflies and anxiety go away. To me, this is what I think. I think I'm relating to these guys. I rode a lot around them for a lot of years. I think once you get that leg up, you think to yourself, hey, this is where I belong. This is what I've done all these years. All the rest, all that nerves and everything goes away. And you might, you know, I know just reminiscing, the only time that you get a little flash is when you hear that old Kentucky home. That song goes right through you. It's beautiful. You know, my old Kentucky home. That's when you might get a little flash and, you know, a little vibration into your face and head. And then you warm up the horses and you're going away from back past the quarter pole and you're concentrating on what your horse is doing and all that crap goes away, you know, and you just say, this is where I belong. This is what I'm supposed to do. Don't matter if it's the Derby or if it's a $3,000 claimer. It doesn't matter. I belong up here. And I guess that's what, you know, guys that don't get a lot of recognition, you know, and some of the names you mentioned, like Calvin, Gutierrez, guys like that. But they do it every day. You know, it's, they call it a muscle memory. Well, I hope the brain isn't considered a muscle, but it has memory. And you blank out a lot of the things that would give you anxiety, and there's brain, it's memory. You know, like muscle memory. This is what I'm supposed to do. Let me relax and do it. That's the way I think.
Yep. No, one of the things that I was so looking forward to as we were driving back Saturday night and Sunday, and, you know, in my head, I drive out of Louisville, and then Tina takes over, and you know, we actually ended up staying in Medina, but we usually eat at that Medina Waffle House. That's a tradition that has been interrupted by COVID. I haven't been able to, you know, reinitiate my Medina Waffle House tradition. We ended up in a different one for breakfast later down the road, but we stayed over in Medina. But as I go through the charts, Tony, and I'm taking notes, and I'm thinking about, you know, Monday, and, you know, then we drove from Rochester Sunday afternoon home, and one of the things I said to myself, well, Mig and Tony will be unbelievable because they can both, having both ridden in the Derby, you know, can both really understand what transpired here with a rider that otherwise, you know, only people that really are watching, you know, watching Belterra and Mahoning and, you know, some of those kinds of, you know, that circuit, that, you know, they all have been singing Sonny's praises, certainly capable, but to come to the Derby and turn in that effort, it'll go down as, you know, one of the most amazing rides. And, you know, one thing that I did, in fact, where is that note here? I had a little piece of paper that I had jotted. I was trying to think of the other Derbies that kind of fell into this category, and of course the easiest, most logical one is Mind That Bird. But if you go a little further back, there always seems to be, about every 12 to 15 years it seems, there's a win like this in this race with lower profile connections, and you know, whether it be trainer or owner or jock or some combination of. And you know who jumped out at me a little bit was Dust Commander in 1970.
Yeah. Mike Manganiello.
And right. isn't that kind of a similar, I mean, a very capable rider and a guy who I'm pretty sure ended up in the steward stand with Don Combs, you know, training, and you know, there's the same kind of a fairly obscure set of connections that, you know, that popped up and won a Derby.
Then he was an established Kentucky rider that I'm sure his biggest thing that he would want to accomplish in his life was to win a Derby. And then he's on Don Combs' horse, and that Derby, and Mike Manganiello, he wins it. It had to be like a dream come true. And, you know, wasn't a a rider that was recognized to the extent prior to that, you know, like you're saying, like a Cordero, a Shoemaker, a Hardtack, a rider like that, or Georgie Velasquez, you know, he was just a homeboy rider. He was there, and he absolutely put a great performance on the horse. You know, when we watch some of these derbies, I bring back the one that I rode. I bring to mind, and it was just another. It was a horse that won Pleasant Colony, but he was ridden by a Georgie Velasquez, and Georgie was one of the renowned riders in the United States at the time. But I think back to that race, and he came from way back off of the pace, and nobody focused like on maybe Georgie. This was just expected of Georgie. It wasn't a Sonny Leon, like, where did this ride come from? It was expected of Georgie. In fact, I remember riding in the race, and I followed Georgie through every hole he went through and around, except when we got to the head of the stretch, he went around the last few horses, and I was done. I was out of horse, and I was lucky to finish fourth. But that was like what you're saying, you know. It wasn't a world-renowned ride. It was a Georgie ride. It was a ride that was expected of him. Where Gutierrez and Calvin Burrell or Sonny Leon don't have that recognition. And what they did was, geez, this is a world-renowned rider, ride that this jock gave this horse. Well, you know what? He's probably done it a zillion other times for some claiming race at Ellis Park or one of the tracks that he raced at that had not the recognition that, you know, of course, that tracks like New York or Churchill or Florida have. But you know what? It's one of those things, and I can't say it enough, when riders ride in these races, the riders that really perform well are the ones that say, this is where I belong. You know, this is what I train for every day. This is what I do. You know, it's not the Kentucky Derby and I got nerves. It's once I got up on that horse and my feet went in the irons and my ass went down on the saddle, and this is what I do. You know, same way I remembered it from the first horse I ever rode. Hey, what am I nervous about? This is what I train to do every day for the last 3 years. This is where I belong. And I'm sure that eases a lot of tension and relieves a rider from a lot of anxiety. It's not, man, this is a Kentucky Derby. What the hell am I doing? I got to get, this is the most prestigious race in the world. That don't play into it. The true athlete is, this is what I do. I put a leg on each side of these beautiful animals. I put the reins in my hands, and when I leave the gate, I have a little bit of mane so I don't fall back on his mouth. I throw my cross, and I sit there and see what's going on in front of me. And that's where it was a little easier for me, because so many times I didn't have to sit there and see what was going on in front of me because I was in front. I like that. I figured maybe that was because I lacked talent when it came to knowing where to go when I'm in behind horses. That's why I liked putting horses on the beat, because I didn't have to know where they're going. They had to know where I'm going. I don't know. I always like making them go. I always like making them go where I've already been.
I love it. I don't know if you heard me earlier either, Tony. I went, you know, Sonny Leon, the Ohio Racing Commission, he had a couple of the stewards, gave him a couple of sets of days. One of the things he did apparently was saw somebody up from coming up the inside. there was clearly way too much space for Joel Rosario to answer. And even if he had seen Sonny Leon coming on Rich Strike, he couldn't have really tightened him up from where he was. But yeah, Sonny, I said, the general public is going to read this and they're going to be like, oh, they suspended the guy. And the horse players are like, yeah, I like Sonny even more now, as if they weren't impressed enough. We know he's a guy that's going to shut you off.
You know, I know, but at the first, I was known as someone you didn't want to come up on the inside of a lot, and I used to let them play up on, I can't see, you know, because that's why I wear these big glasses. I'm saying, well, what do you come up on the inside of me for if I can't see? But anyway, one day, Benny Feliciano at Bowie Racetrack come up on the inside of me, and boy, I laid him up against the fence. Didn't come close to dropping him. He finally, you know, we come to the wire. I mean, he was pissed and screaming, and then he claimed foul, and of course they took me down, and they gave me 15 days for rough riding. And I thought, that was the biggest suspension I ever had. And my friend Jimbo Bracali was on the lead, and they all thought, well, you're doing that because Bracali's on the lead. No, I'm not doing it because Bracali's on the lead and I'm laying second. I'm doing it because I don't want you to get in the habit of coming through on me. And I'll never forget, I'm back in the jock room. I'm back in the jock's room, and I'm just brushing my hair back because I didn't ride the next race. And I get a tap on the shoulder, and I turn around, and it's Feliciano, and he cold cocked me. He suckered me. And we didn't go to fist the coffin because I'm too bad. I ain't going to fight with somebody with fists. But I went and I put some wrestling moves on him, and I was just ready to slam him and put him on his back, and they broke it up. So then I said, well, here I got beat. I got beat. He sucker punched me, and I got beat, but he was going to get pinned. And the next day, the stewards looked at me and said, what the hell was you doing? I said, well, I thought it was a tight spot for him to be going into. But Benny and I have since been friends and had a lot of laughs about the whole thing. But I'll never forget turning around, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and bam, and he hit me right in the side of the head with a closed fist. But this old Greek didn't go down for the count. I come back with my wrestling. I was wrestling, Steve. And then they broke it out. Old Billy, that was memory from old Billy.
The ghost of the buoy jock rope. Tony, I gotta pull up. I did also want to add in Kathy Passmore came by and saw me and surprised me. She brought me a bunch of taffy, which was very thoughtful, and I know that you seem to have something to do with it, so thank you. It was great to meet her.
Well, she's such a sweet girl, and I remember her growing up, and her dad was a real mainstay rider, Bill Passmore, in Maryland, and he was a major positive influence on guys like Chris McCarron and many others that came around. I thought the world of Mr. Passmore, and a great official. I thought the world riding underneath of him also. Someday maybe he'll get the recognition he deserves, and I hope he makes it into the National Horse Racing Hall of Fame, because Bill Passmore was definitely a Hall of Famer. But you take care, and I forgot to tell you she was coming to see you. That I apologize to her, because I was supposed to tell you, and I forgot, because she told me she had the saltwater taffy for you. So, once again, too many concussions, and Kath, if you're listening, I apologize for not telling you. But she's a great gal, and what a beautiful little girl, and she grew up to be such a beautiful little lady. But love you, Steve. Keep up the good work. I'll let you go. I've taken up enough of your time. Love you, Steve.
Not at all.
The good work. Bye now.
Tony, thank you, buddy. Love you. We'll talk next week from Baltimore, and we'll have some Preakness memories as well with Tony, and Tony won his share, boy, over the Oval at Pimlico during his Maryland years, and Joe Clancy is going to join us next. And as we get ready for Joe, Ron Anderson, by the way, is going to visit next hour, as well as Rich Ang. But let me check and see if Andy sent out the scratches for Belmont today. It feels like it should be about Andy Belmont scratch time. It is, and good, there is a horse scratched out of the six. That's kind of what I was maybe hoping for. So we'll look at that in the last hour. We'll look at the pick six sequence. I want to mention, as Casey reaches Joe Clancy, I do want to slip in, I've been carrying it around for weeks for after Derby. America's Best Racing has gotten involved in the long-running party that for years has been at the Mount Washington Tavern. And of course, there was a few years where the tavern was being rebuilt after the fire. But Mount Washington Tavern next Wednesday. And tickets are on sale at Eventbrite. $25 if you buy them in advance. It'll be $35 on site next Wednesday. And this is essentially a fundraiser, Beyond the Wire, that does a great job. There's also, I retweeted it last night, there's a terrific memorabilia auction that's going on online. I'll retweet that again. But this is a $25 ticket that provides appetizers and bar snacks, etc. Plus, you're entered into a drawing for two Preakness tickets as well. There's a silent auction that'll be going on with a bunch of things, and as I mentioned, there's the online side of it. But the Mount Washington Tavern party for years has, and in fact, it feels like they're calling this the seventh annual, and so this must go back to after they reopened after the fire. And of course, there was real concern that after the fire, there would be no more Mount Washington Tavern. But one of the, and here's Joe Clancy in the background, and I bet you Joe's had his share of Guinnesses at the Mount Washington Tavern.
Now there's an introduction. Thanks. I haven't had any for breakfast at the Mount Washington Tavern. Let's say that.
Well, that's only by accident. That's because you'd only had breakfast you'd had Guinness for breakfast elsewhere.
Right, there you go.
Well, they'll be hosting. Let's see. They'll be hosting Guinnesses. They'll be hosting some Natty Bows. For those of you that have no idea what we're talking about, a Natty Bow, a National Bohemian, the official beer of Baltimore. They'll be hoisting it in Joe's honor, as named yesterday as the Old Hilltop winner. And I'm actually surprised, Joe, that you weren't already a recipient of the Old Hilltop. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And as you well know, as a winner of it in 2019, it sort of makes you step back a little bit. You know, like, I don't think I've been doing this long to deserve something like that. But it's an amazing honor, and even it hits home when you look at the past winners of it and things, and it just sort of makes you take stock and makes you go, maybe I have been doing this as long as some of these people, which is, it's just a cool tribute. I love that Pimlico continues to do stuff like this. I mean, it's a great link to the history and the past of it all, which is fun.
Very much. And of course, one of the other aspects of the Old Hilltop, it comes along with the Alibi Breakfast, which is one of the great traditions in all of racing, that started initially as a just sort of a gathering outside the racing office, where the Derby, the horses exiting the Derby would assemble the horsemen, and everybody would offer their excuses for why they didn't win the Derby. That's the Alibis. And as Johnny D famously says, it's also a great excuse to eat fried chicken for breakfast.
Exactly. And again, just like the awards, the tradition of it, and I can only imagine, you know, back in the day of that stately Pimlico clubhouse and the characters and people who were involved and the Alibis, you know, I'm sure it was amazing and just kind of like a racing history lesson, but live and in person, you know, back then. And it continues to be. I mean, you certainly remember the various people who've done it and the way they kind of give every trainer or every horse's connection a chance to say a little something. Sometimes we get alibis, sometimes we get comedy routines, sometimes we get not quite guarantees, but you do get some people, you know, who tout their horses and talk about it, which is it's a great opportunity. And the mix of people at the Alibi Breakfast, I think, is always fun too. It just kind of spans every inch of racing from the top to the bottom, and we missed it with the COVID pandemic and restrictions and things, and you know, to have it come back is really neat.
Very much. It's a little bit frustrating for me, because I've only been able to attend the breakfast one time, and that was that was because they were going to hand me a glass bowl, so I guess I had to go, and so I jumped off the air. Casey ran a tape for the last, I don't know, I guess hour of the show, because I, what else could I do? I do have, you know what though, I do have this new piece of equipment that that operates on Wi-Fi, and I might be able to broadcast from the room. That's if they wouldn't mind. Maybe we'll do. You know what, Joe? Might have to
live from the Alibi Breakfast. I like it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, all right. I'll talk to Dave Joseph about that. That
no maple syrup on the equipment, though. Be careful. Don't drip any maple syrup or fried chicken crumbs or anything on the equipment. That probably doesn't fly. In case he would not be happy. So.
Well, this is the latest. There's a lot of fun things I'm going to have to be trained how to do. I mean, I did use it before we went to Derby. I'd used it when we were at Sanibel. Was the first experience with it, and we had a couple of drops a couple of times that the because it operates on Wi-Fi and it's got two antennas so that it can bounce around from different wherever it can get the Wi-Fi signals, and if I have a hot spot with me that, you know, like a Nighthawk, mm-hmm. that I can use that. Plus the thing operates on, it's got 6 hours of battery power, so I don't even need electricity. It's very cool. Yeah, I think at Saratoga this summer, we're going to have some fun. We'll do some shows from, you know, different places. It should be cool. So maybe this will be...
It's amazing, the changes.
Yeah. Live remote. Well, Joe, a couple of things. We got a bunch of... We can really use this conversation as a partial transition from Derby to Preakness, you know, not just because you're getting the old Hilltop Award, but also because we're, you know, tracking to Baltimore. We'll be there Sunday afternoon. But before we talk about a few things Pimlico-related, let's get your Derby thoughts and your Derby recap.
It kind of blew everybody away, right? I was watching from the University of Maryland. My son Nolan turned 21 years old on Derby Day, so being the cool parents we are, my wife Sam and I went down and hosted his friends and him for the Texas 250 barbecue, which is the best barbecue in D.C., and a little Derby party. But when number 21 crossed the finish line first, all of Nolan's friends went, "We really didn't bet that horse on Nolan's 21st birthday." And so
oh my god!
So.
Oh my god! That's funny, yeah. Right?
Yeah, right. And I'm like, well, it's not the lottery. It doesn't always work that way, you know. But I mean, he you can't take anything away from his race, that's for sure. And plenty of people have analyzed and talked about it, and we've all seen the video replay of the ride that Sonny Leon gave him and the charge that horse put in. And you know, it looks like a fluke, but it's not his race was not a fluke. He ran that race and ran everybody down, you know? So to me it was very reminiscent of Mind That Bird, you know, and the way he did it. And I was second, third, and fourth with a trifecta box. That wasn't very, you know, with a 35-1 shot in the mix, but oh well. It was an amazing race to watch. You know, the joy and the surprise and all of the connections afterwards were priceless, and just a great example of what can happen in racing.
Exactly. The improbability of it. I referenced the story in the Globe and Mail column from one of their sports guys, and unfortunately I tried to go back to it and send it out. A guy by the name of in fact I sent him an email too, and I realize I haven't heard back. His name's Cathal, like Cathal Lynch, who goes by Cal. So Cathal, his name is Cathal Kelly, and he wrote a terrific piece just saying the reason it's so wonderful is because we're so used to a certain rote when it comes to high-level sports. I mean, it's one of the reasons that St. Peter's run in the NCAAs was just so refreshing. And that's part of the appeal here, is just that you look at this before the race, and I've been saying all week that if everybody had more time to look at him and understand that, you know, he was going to be a late runner in a race that had the potential for a pace collapse, you could look at him like a Barber Road light, a horse that could clunk up potentially for third or fourth, but him winning it just the 30 claimer angle, and Eric Reed's the loss at Mercury Training Center and the fire, and it just has so many winning elements to it, and the fact that people were just dumbstruck by the result. This just doesn't happen that often, although my net bird is not all that far afield in people's memory.
No, and you're right to compare it to other sports upsets, and that's why we like sports. And underneath it all, I mean, sure, you want to see excellence and the cream rise to the top, and you see, just in like in other sports, people, teams spending on to acquire free agents or whatever to build a winning team, but that still doesn't guarantee you victory. And I think that Rich Strike doesn't know he's 80-1, and he ran the race of his life, and it happened on Derby Day. If he didn't get in the race, it might have happened, in some other race 2 weeks from now. We don't know. And I think that's why we watch. That's why we're interested. It's why you watch sports. It's what, because you don't know the outcome, whether it's racing or whether it's something else. You ultimately don't know. An upset like this can happen. A horse or a performer or whatever, an athlete, whatever, with a backstory like this can come along. Here it is, and on the one hand, it's great. It's very, the storyline is really cool for racing. I think from a straight gambling standpoint, I think some people get frustrated with results that seem so out of the norm, but again, it's why they let you bet on it, because occasionally an 80-1 shot can run by everybody, and it was something to watch. I hear a lot of opinions now as to, oh, it was a total fluke. He'll be lucky to, he'll be seventh. He'll be up the track in the Preakness. But I think, the Mind That Burn probably had the same thoughts, and
yep,
he was second. It took Rachel Alexander to beat him. Again, we don't know, that takes nothing away from the source of Derby win. He proved that he did it.
And one thing that I think everybody will get next week is going to be a refresher course in Mind That Bird. And, Orb, of course, came from the back of the pack and passes the ball to win the Derby, of course, did it as favorite, and so it's a different scenario. But the style aspect of this, it puts him up against it. But what people may forget about Mind That Bird, we've already said it this week, was that if Rachel Alexandra doesn't contest the Preakness, well, Mind That Bird probably wins the Preakness and goes to New York with a chance at a Triple Crown. And if Calvin Burrell had actually taken a couple of mounts on Friday or Saturday to get familiar with the racetrack, who knows where Mind That Bird finishes. But it's not as if after the 50-1 win, he then just faded into obscurity.
Yeah. No, and looking at it, he obviously had more form coming into the Derby, and had won a stakes and had done more than this horse,
That's
so,
right.
Obviously there's not 20 horses, and I doubt there's going to be the pace there was in front of him, but, the horse just ran that well. He could certainly bounce out of that race and run that well again.
Well, the field is certainly, if we're looking for intrigue, having Epicenter commit, and I think everybody expected that the Mitchells and Wayne Lucas were going to try the filly once she won the way she did on Friday. It just felt like that was going to be irresistible. So you add those two in, and Antonio Seno is already bedded down with Simplification already. When you put this field the way Creative Minister, which has got a real McPeak Sarava feel to it, actually Sarava I think prepped in the Sir Barton before the Belmont, but this is a progressive McPeak 3-year-old. The field has come together. You got early voting waiting. I mean, we're gonna be treated to a very nice cast for next Saturday.
Yeah, it's fun to see, and again, from some sort of coming at it from different angles. You know, with the Kentucky Oaks winner, with the horse who the early voting angle, where he didn't go to Kentucky and aim for here, and it's just coming at it from different angles and different places. I think makes it that much more interesting, and makes it it makes it that much of a better race, or a good race on paper anyway, that you end up with these horses. And I guess that's a little bit the product of if Epicenter drew off and won the Derby by 10, you might have a few people calling audibles and not necessarily coming to the Preakness. So that's a little bit of the product of an upset in the Derby, in that it doesn't necessarily push anybody else away from the Preakness. I mean, if that horse can do that, then why not? It's good. Again, after all the various upheavals over the last couple of years, where the Preakness ended up in October and whatever else, to have a good race on the right date is a good thing.
Well, and I was just trying to find an entry from one of the wager guides. I'll dig it up, because I want to remember what I wrote about Mind That Bird going in. I've got them all saved somewhere. I'm going to find it, because I want to have a dialogue on that front. Joe, the rest of the weekend, I guess we touched on Secret Oath a little bit out of this. What else did you find notable about Derby Oaks weekend?
It's the depth and the quality of racing that we can put together, if the Derby didn't happen, I think racing fans would have been, just blown away by the 2 days of racing that we put together. which I think is great. I mean, it's like a mini Breeders' Cup, or whatever you want to call it, where when we can get horses like that together, and at all, with the turf racing and the at all levels, and at all for all conditions, and Pimlico does it on a little slightly smaller scale, but it's still from a racing fan standpoint, to see the races that show up, or the horses that show up for these races, it's phenomenal. I mean, it makes all three, when you count the Belmont, it makes all three weekends just such first class. I think specifically, I mean, when you watch you had an upset when Three Technique wins that race, at a huge price, and then most of the others were fairly formful. Jack Christopher, to me, was really impressive. I mean, that was pretty cool, and to see him come back, and it'll be really interesting to see where he goes next, which direction they take, it would be fun to hopefully we get to see him in with these 3-year-olds going two turns and looking Epicenter in the eye, and at least at some point, and again, good, which is good for racing when we see stuff like that. That's the idea.
Let's transition. Joe Clancy with us. This is horseracing.com. And last week, of course, at Churchill with Tom Law. And Joe, heading toward Preakness. With Tom last week, I couldn't help but bring up, I think the night before, actually, I had tweeted out the link to the unbelievably wonderful piece that very well could earn you. How many eclipses have you won?
One, which is hard enough.
All right. Well, then. All right. So then, I thought I would have taken the over. How many? What about Sean?
Sean has won. Sean, Tom, and I all have won. So we should probably not enter anymore. And then we can all say
don't worry. No, don't worry about going after more. There's plenty of chazas that don't seem to that aren't inhibited that way. So you shouldn't be either, I guess. Because the piece will be a major contender on that front as a feature, and it was one that was really close, as I told Tom, very close to my heart, because Del Carroll II was really the first horseman I got to know on the racetrack. Going back to the 90s, and he taught me a tremendous, whenever I had a question, he taught me a tremendous amount, and I would walk around and just watch, listen to Dell, and just a fabulous horseman who in so many ways gave the industry essentially AP Indy because of Weekend Surprise. His father, a legendary horseman, and I wrote in that tweet that the story masquerades as a Preakness story revolving around BBB, but in reality, it's an ode to Red Carroll and him as a patriarch of a bunch of horsemen, son and daughter, and as well as a polo legend, one of the greatest polo players in American history. And if I'm not mistaken, his pony is basically the man of war of he's the man of war of stallions for polo ponies. It's a story that doesn't have enough recognition, and that's why I thought it was wonderful that you gave it the treatment you did.
Yeah, thank you. It was hard to write. I remember. I mean, I kept working on it and coming back to it, and it had been on a list here at Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred for a while. I mean, BBB was a Maryland bred. Obviously, Del Carroll was a Mid-Atlantic type trainer, even though he went all over. And so there were plenty of angles, and I'm like, probably a year ago, you know, you're like, oh, the 50th anniversary is coming up here, you know, and we should think about it, you know. And he beat River Ridge in an upset, and I wasn't sure I could find enough people who were around 50 years ago to, you know, kind of help tell the story. I clearly wasn't there. I was 7 years old, so I wasn't there. But I remember Del Carroll. I mean, I remember his barn. He had a big, long barn at Delaware Park that you would ride by on the horse path. It was right next to it, right behind the track kitchen, you know, and it was always just like a first-class operation. You'd go by that barn, like, whoa, that's Del Carroll's barn, you know. But anyway, I got lucky and got, you know, I went over it with Vinny Ferrone first and talked with him about maybe writing this, and he was tied up with some other stuff, so I dove in. And I got lucky and found Robin Carroll. She was Robin Martin then. She's married to Del II. And she was there, you know, and she was an exercise rider. She was 17 years old. And, her insight to it was great. It really kind of put you there, you know. And I remember I was talking to her and just, you know, the hair starts to stand up on your arm when she starts telling the story about them having so many runners that they needed people to come back. And Del Carroll asked the exercise riders to volunteer to help, and nobody volunteered because they all wanted to go to Preakness infield, you know. So they drew straws, and she drew the straw that got BBB. So there she was, you know, and it just kind of went from there. It could have been twice as long, really. I mean, with more phone calls and more people to talk to and keep telling the story. I mean, as you touched on, Del Carroll's, you know,
life as a horseman, polo-wise, racing-wise, you know, is a great tale, you know, and it's got everything. I mean, he won a lot of races. He died, you know, tragically in an accident at Keeneland, which really hit home this spring when that happened again, you know, and would have trained another, you know, I don't know, he would have trained another 10, 20 years, you know, and he had, BBB was owned by Will Farish, and, you know, the very early, he was in his 30s, so it was a very early, the early start of Will Farish's kind of ramping up to the power of their breeding industry, their breeding program at Lane's End, and, you know, he would have only gotten better and better horses to train, you know, it's something. I don't know if my story is great, but it's a great story, and I'm glad I dove in and kept making phone calls, and I found his daughter Lark, who's a veterinarian in Kentucky, and she was a toddler when he died, you know, and there's a lot to it, and there's more to it, which someday it'd be fun to really get into all that and keep telling it, you know. You know, it kind of just sort of came together. I remember giving a version to Barry Reitler at the magazine to start doing some layout, and I said, "Well, it's going to get a lot longer, I hope." And you know, a week later, it was 1,000 words longer and had 3 or 4 more sources to it. You know, so it kind of just kept going, and you know, it's in the May Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred print magazine, and it's online at Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred website. And I hope it gets the, you know, it deserves a lot of readers, just because it was a fun story to tell, a hard story to tell, but you know, it was a fun story to tell for sure.
Well, and a few of the aspects that you hinted at here that are fascinating, and the way I got to know some of those details that you fleshed out, it came from Funny Sides, the lead up to Funny Sides Preakness, and I had just really started in earnest with my Derby Trail website, and after Derby, it became obvious with the ridiculous incident involving Jose Santos and Funny Side and the clown show at the Miami Herald, that you knew that Barkley and Santos, they were going to win resoundingly, that everything they could do to just put a authoritative stamp on Funny Side and his credibility was going to happen. So, I mean, it, to me, Funny Side was 1 to 100. Then it became, how are we going to bet this Preakness? And as I went through that field, when I came by Midway Road, I thought to myself, well, this is a little strange that Neil Howard is certainly not a guy that, you know, is taking an allowance horse and is going to run in the Preakness. So I started going through charts to see the last time that Lane's End and Will Farish had run a horse in the Preakness. 2002, 2001, 2000, 99, 98, 97, 96, 95, 94, 95. And all of a sudden, I worked my way back to BBB. So I say to myself, let's see. He has not run a horse in this race in 30-plus years. So I called Dell. And I said, Dell, would Neil Howard, would they be running and he said, absolutely not, unless Neil said that the horse is doing great, then Mr. Farish might say, go ahead, because that's what happened with BBB. And then he proceeded to tell me the story. And he said, you know, he had just come out of a race, 10 days earlier, and they knew the forecast was for rain all week long. He was, you know, there's horses that get over the wet okay, and then there's mudlarks. There's horses that literally really do move up on mud. And there was him, and who was just a freak in the wet. So they knew he was going to get his kind of racetrack. And Dell the second went to his dad and said, you know, BBB's doing, he's doing great, Dad. And so he called Farish and said, horse is doing great. And he said, if you think he can, you know, he can do well, then go ahead and enter him. And that's how they got into the race, and they win. And you know, the one thing I guess you didn't, the one portion of the story that didn't get touched on, maybe this is why, you know, there's a part two, was Eldon Nelson at 53, at 54. How old was Eldon Nelson at the time?
Yeah, and in that ballpark, I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, I mean, and same thing. I sort of ran into, okay, if I dive, if I keep going that way, my story is going to be, you know, need 10 more pages in the magazine, and that wasn't happening. So, yeah, I mean, he was kind of a, you know, I remember I kept talking to my dad about the story all along as I was working on it, and he remembered Eldon Nelson riding at Delaware Park and always, you know, kind of being a leading jockey at Delaware Park every season. And then, you know, they either, you know, they kind of lost track of him, but then he sort of, then he came back around again, you know, and there he was winning the Preakness with BBB. And it was neat to hear Robin and Heather Buchanan, Del's former assistant, you know, both say that the jockeys kind of never rattled, totally cool, whatever attitude, how much that helped BBB. And, you know, like he wasn't overwhelmed by taking on Reaver Ridge and Keita the Mint and these other horses in the Preakness. And one of them, I think Heather Buchanan, compared him to, you know, he was like Pat Day. Like, you know, he just got on the horse and rode the race, you know, and it was kind of cool to hear that side of it a little bit. But yeah, again, he could have gone another direction. Maybe there's a BBB book or a Del Carroll book somewhere along the line, if we can tell everybody's story.
Well, Tony and Tony Black sent me a couple of notes. He mentioned that Eldon Nelson had actually retired, and then to his cattle ranch, I think in Nebraska, if I'm not mistaken. He's either from Nebraska or Iowa. Because I wanted to write something at that time for the website, and I reached out, and he was quite, and I think he was still alive, but I forget how. I think I still have the notes, actually, because I've got my files about things I've wanted to write about. That Tony Black confirms it's Nebraska. He came back, and Chuck Baltasar says Kansas. So it's all right, Tony and Chuck, you guys work it out.
And he's in the Oklahoma Horse Racing Hall of Fame, so he covered all those states out there.
Well, I'm not going to use that disparaging term about that involves aircraft, somewhere out there in the Midwest. And they're still firing at me here.
Yeah,
Chuck, wait a minute. Tony says he thinks Chuck is right, that Chuck Baltasar's got it with Kansas. The point is, he came out of retirement and was only eclipsed by Shoemaker, right? When Shoemaker, he became the oldest jock to win a Triple Crown race, and then Shoemaker eclipsed that on Ferdinand.
Yeah, and has Mike Smith got them both beat now? Or I don't know. It's got to be close anyway. So yeah,
that's a good question. I think Shoe is still. I think Shoemaker is still the oldest. Let me see. Now we're gonna go. Let's go to the video.
There goes the rabbit hole. Be careful.
Exactly. He became. Let's see. He the oldest rider, 54, to win. Well, that's just referring to the Derby, I think, as opposed to any Triple Crown race. Interesting. All right. Well, we'll do some post show research. It's an amazing story, and I will retweet again the link to Joe's piece BBB and Red Carroll. And I met Lark, which is, for those of you that are having daughters, Larkspur is about as cool a name for your daughter as you'll ever hear. And she was just finishing, vet school when I met her. I'm almost positive she had just graduated vet school. I met her in 90, whatever it was.
So, yeah, she was, she received some scholarships through the Maryland Racing Media Association to help pay for that, too. I remember, that's where I met her, I think. And then, you know, and she's carved out a niche in racing, too. I mean, she's very sought after in terms of some chiropractic work with horses and acupuncture told me some cool. She was very involved with Wise Dan and helping Charlie Lopresti with him, and you know, has a career of her own in racing, that's for sure. So, again, the reach kind of just filters out in all these different directions.
Joe, what is the This Is Horse Racing schedule for coming up for this week?
Well, like always, this time of year, everything finds a new gear, so you're running in about a million different directions trying to get everything that you need to get in various places. The Iroquois Steeplechase is Saturday, so you know, we've got the Grade One jumpers going at it, and you know, I'll probably get to Pimlico. Hoping to get there this weekend, but that's still a possibility. But I'll be there Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and back and forth for a while, and then on the hotel room for later in the week to try to save some gas money. But we'll, you know, we'll comb through some previews and see what we come up with for sure. And you know, we've got to again follow the jump stuff, and we're the crazy deadline of Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred is. You know, we have to finish the June magazine today. Well, it feels like today, not quite today, but soon, as soon as possible. And then, you know, then we'll turn the page and get the Preakness stuff and the 2-year-old sale and every other thing.
Excellent. Well, Joe, we'll see you next week. We'll see if we can't bring you out for a celebratory lunch at Pioneer Pit Beef. How about that?
Sounds great.
All right. You and Grenig. Grenig, I know that it resonated with Grenig when I took him, because he said to me in when we were in Louisville, he said to me, "We going to that barbecue place again?" I said, yeah, Pioneer Pit Beef. You bet.
Well, you had sent us some of the links to the DC stuff, and as we turned out, that Texas 250 place is basically on campus at College Park, so we've been several times now. So if anybody's down that direction of Maryland, the Texas 250 barbecue cannot be overhyped. It is really good stuff, and it's in Riverdale, and just south Riverdale Park, Maryland, just south of College Park, not far from Laurel. If you get a chance to go to Laurel, you can go get some really good stuff. They post a menu, but they say, you know, we're not really sure what we'll have because we have what we have, and we cook, and when it's gone, you know. So it's well worth the trip if anybody can get that direction.
Cool. Nice push. Very good. Joe Clancy, everybody, and the Saratoga Special / This Is Horse Racing team, as well as the Horseman's Journal and the Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred, and you name it, the New York Thoroughbred Breeders stuff, they do it all. Joe, I will see you next week.
Great, thanks for your time. See ya.
Joe Clancy, everybody. Let's take a break. We're 20 minutes into hour three. We'll take a quick break, come back, Ron Anderson, and we'll close it out with Rich Ang. I need Rich's help. I may end up, speaking of the all button, I may have to use that all button in that sixth race now in the Belmont carryover. The field is six after a scratch, and I don't know how you Maiden 25, state bred fillies. I don't know. All right. Ron Anderson, when we come back.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Defining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning. Learn more at countrylifefarm.com.
Hoistman, nominate now for the $400,000 Grade II Penn Mile and the $150,000 Penn Oaks. Both races will be run Friday, June 3rd, each at 1 mile on the grass at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse. Nominations close Wednesday, May 18th. Contact the Penn National Race.